This is Payne Roberts. I am in Norman Park, Georgia, interviewing Kenny Roberts, who happens to be my dad. First of all, I guess just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm Kenny Roberts, and I was born here in Norman Park, Georgia, in the farming community on the farm. And I was raised here most of my life. And I've done a little bit of all kind of things, and music has been my highlight.
Okay. Well, when did you start getting involved in music?
Well, basically when I was 11 years old in 51, I started singing in a gospel quartet with two of my brothers and a cousin. And we sang here and there and get-togethers and became... Several times we sang at all night gospel sings with the big quartets, national quartets, and we enjoyed that very much.
Were you the youngest in the quartet? Or what part did, and also what part did you sing in the quartet?
I sang first tenor at that time, and I was the youngest in the quartet, yes.
Okay, who taught you what you know about music?
Well, mostly self-taught. Playing guitar, my uncle showed me the basic chords on the guitar, and I picked it up from there, what I know now.
Yeah. Okay, and you said your brothers sang with you in the quartet. Did any of your other family members play a part in your music experience?
Not particularly, except they stood behind me and backed me 100%.
Yeah. Well, you said you sang in a gospel quartet. Excuse me. What kind of music inspired you to start singing the country pop?
Well, primarily Elvis Presley came on the scene big in the mid to late 60s, and I enjoyed that so much. I was inspired more by him than any other one entertainer.
Now, did you get your band together? And how did you get your band together?
Well, I decided... in 56 to get a band, put a band together and start singing the type of music that I like, the Elvis Presley type music and such. And I formed a band and played at parties and at fraternity houses in Athens and here and there at little clubs around and, you know, just enjoyed myself.
Okay, well, how did you get discovered, by the, I guess, Nashville people, or?
Well, Bootle O'Brien, who is a songwriter and wrote songs 16 consecutive million sellers for the Everly Brothers, among many, many other million sellers, his mom and dad lived in Moultrie, and I met him through them, and he got me placed with Decca Records in Nashville, Tennessee, and wrote my songs, and recorded them and was released and did quite well.
Well, so you've made, how many recordings have you made?
Offhand, I don't know how many, but professional recordings, I've made about 10 or 12.
When you were making these recordings, were you living in Nashville?
No, I was living here, well, to start with, but then later on I moved to Nashville and recorded some then while I was living there.
Did you perform with any artists to speak of? You know, who did you perform with when you were there?
Well, I fronted the show for Conway Twitty, Jerry Lee Lewis, Charlie Rich, and numerous others.
Okay. So, can you describe the country pop style or something about it to let me know?
Well, the country pop I consider as country pop is the Elvis Presley type. Love Me Tender, Don't Be Cruel, Jim Reeves, He'll Have to Go, that type music. That was my type music.
Okay, and I'm gonna record a few of your selections after we do the interview so we can have a taste of that. Have you written any of your own music?
Yes, I have. None that you would know, but I have had written some songs that have been released on the public market.
Okay. Have any interesting stories from the days? Okay, Dad. Well, I'm just gonna give you an open floor now. I wanna hear some stories about your experiences and who you played with and who you met and just whatever you want to tell us. Open floor.
Okay, Payne. When I first started recording, in fact, before I started recording, I would bring Jerry Lee Lewis to Moultrie and to Douglas and Valdosta and towns around, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I would open the show for him. In fact, one time in Moultrie, Jerry Lee was, of course, it's a hometown community and farming community. And there was grandmothers, mothers, and grandkids there, you know. Everybody mm-hmm. there to see Jerry Lee Lewis play. And, of course, he started his sort of shady type actions on stage. And the whole auditorium, which was packed out, booed him off the stage. And because I had opened the show and he came on second, then in intermission he come to me and asked me what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, you know, why he didn't do that in front of these people, because
right.
that's somebody's little kids out there and they ain't going to put up with that. You
mm-hmm.
know? And he went back out and sat down on the piano stool, and they was booing him all the time at his second appearance. And he just run the piano, the keyboard, and started singing "Your Cheating Heart." And that time they tore the house down, you know.
Yeah, that was at Moultrie, huh?
In Moultrie, and we went on to Tifton and Douglas and Valdosta, and I'm not sure where all we performed on that tour.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we had Conway Twitty here, and was around several towns too. And Conway Twitty, after I got to know him, I realized that his name was not Conway Twitty, it's Harold Jenkins, is his real name.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he picked up the name Conway Twitty as a stage name from a little town in Texas and one in Arkansas, right across the border from each other. Conway, Arkansas, and Twitty, Texas.
So
he took that name as his performing name. One time when I was in Memphis, at the Little Black Book Club, playing there, for Eddie Bond owned the club, and well, he had a performance contest with a machine that gauges the reaction from the audience.
Mm, the applause.
And applause, and the winner got $50. And Mickey Gilley was on that show, and
you were
doing just as well, and I was on the show, and he was doing just as well as he ever did. Of course, he was not a big name at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I won the $50. Well, how about that? Of course, Charlie Rich, he was a gentleman, a very, very fine fella. And in Memphis, we played the Lamplighter Club together for a month, 6 nights a week. And we played from 9 till 2. Of course, Charlie liked to drink a little bit, and he would drink all night. And he gets to the south, he couldn't walk, but he could sit down and play the prettiest piano and sing the prettiest song you've ever heard. You know,
uh-huh.
I never figured out how he did that, but he could do it. And of course, when I was in Nashville recording and in the music business, I did a lot of rubbing elbows with stars or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Columbia studio, we'd play ping pong. I'd play ping pong with Hank Williams Jr. and Floyd Kramer and Grady Martin and guys like that. And the first recording I made with Decca Records, I went in the studio, a little old boy from South Georgia that didn't know anybody or didn't know anything. And I'd heard of Grady Martin, the guitar player, Floyd Kramer, the pianist, you know, Buddy Harmon, the drummer, Lightning Chance, the bass player, walked in there, and the Jordanaires, Anita Kerrs, and all of them were in there. And it was like somebody shot a gun at a rabbit. I was scared. I didn't know what I was doing, and they had me named as the leader of the session.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know nothing about it. And Grady Martin, the guitar player, saw I was frightened, and he took me into the break room and said, let's go in and have a cup of coffee first, you know. Sort of got me settled down, and we went back in, and all my band, we would practice, you know, at night up at Mama's house, and we'd practice, getting ready for a show somewhere or something. And when I went in there for that first record session, these professional musicians, Floyd Kramer got me over to the piano and set me down on a stool by him and wanted me to go over a couple of bars of the song. I sung probably half of the song, and he said, that's enough. And he started calling out numbers of the chords and the changes and the augmented and the whatever. And I didn't know nothing about that. But they went over a couple of times, and they were ready to record it, just like they had played it all their life. And I mean, did a fantastic job, you know.
But that just floored
it. It just knocked me flat. I couldn't believe anybody, any human being, could be that talented.
That must have been really exciting.
It was really exciting. And the experiences like that is something that most people don't ever have. But I was lucky enough to have some of those experiences. And speaking of Eddie Bond, he lived in Memphis and owned the Little Blackfoot Club. And he and his band came to Adel, played in the gymnasium there. And my drummer at that time went back to Memphis with Eddie Bond as his drummer. And then Morris Tarrant was his name. And from there, Morris went to play full-time for Jerry Lee Lewis. And then he played here and in foreign countries with Little Richard and several others, but mostly he played with Jerry Lee Lewis, and as fine a drummer as I've ever heard play. And he has moved back to Sparks now. He lives in Sparks. He's a carpenter.
Right down the road.
Yep, right down the road from us here. And while we were in Memphis one time, Eddie Bond and another guy took me over to Elvis's, to Graceland, to Elvis's house, and we got in Elvis's old black van, and he had on a black hat and a black leather jacket. He drove us down to the restaurant and went behind the restaurant in the alley, because he called first and got hamburgers ordered. We had hamburgers and Pepsi Colas in that van on the way back to Graceland.
In Elvis's van.
In Elvis's. Elvis's van. There again, I say not many people have had the opportunity of meeting Elvis.
No.
But I have fallen into some pretty lucky spots in that business, and feel very fortunate for it. And Elvis Presley was one of the finest young men I'd ever met.
That is just cool. That's just cool.
Scotty Moore, which was Elvis's guitar player, became a good friend of mine and in Nashville. And he quit playing for Elvis. So I asked him one day why he quit playing. He said, well, when you've done it all, what else is there to do? You know, so, you know, a guitar player or any kind of musician would say, why would you quit playing for Elvis? You know, well, it becomes old hat, you know. It's nothing big anymore. Yeah. It's just a job. And he's a very nice fellow too, Scotty is. And he's now, he got in a recording studio and was producing records in Nashville, and now he's making tapes and CDs in a factory he got there. But after I got out of the performing end of it, it became old hat to me too, you know. And it just got to be in a rat race. And a friend of mine, Carl Friend, his name, and he was from Arkansas, we started producing records for people. And we had an office in the 16th Avenue, 812 16th Avenue in Nashville. And in the same building was Johnny Cash's office, George Jones' office, and several others, Tammy Wynette's office, with Billy Sherrill, who was the Epic Record man, he was there too. Johnny Cash's office right next door to us. And one day his brother, who run Johnny's office, Tommy Cash, came over and asked us if we'd go help him look for Johnny. Johnny was missing for 2 days and didn't nobody know where he was. So we went with him. He said he thought he knew where he might be. An old house that Johnny liked out on the edge of Nashville. And there was snow on the ground, wind blowing, it was cold, cold. We went out there and we went in that old house and you could see the ground through the floor, you know, just go crack in the floor. And Johnny was laying on the floor, passed out, with just a t-shirt on. It's good he was drunk, because he'd have froze to death if he hadn't been.
Yeah. You know?
We took him to the hospital and got him checked out. He was all right. And then we took him to the Andrew Jackson Hotel and got him to bed. And things like that, you know, you really don't. Now it's no big thing to me, but if I'd never done it, it would have been a big thing, you know.
Yeah, it's a big thing to me. Yeah. That's pretty cool, all that stuff.
Yeah, I've had a lot of experiences in this business, and I went over to Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Tyler, Texas, and did some recording with the United Southern Artists record.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been all over the United States doing shows and tours and a club opening in Denver, Colorado one time, and it was so cold I'd like to die. We moved around a lot and got to know and appreciate the talents and the people of the big artists. Now, the big people are just like me and the little people, all the little people. They put their pants on one leg at a time.
Mm-hmm.
They're no different than anybody else. Although they seem to be some superstars, they are just people.
Mm-hmm. Once
just
you get
talented
to know them.
People. Right. You get to know them, you realize that one man is no bigger than another.
Mm-hmm.
It's the man himself that what makes him what he is. And now, Elvis Presley was one of those kind. He was, because it was in the early 60s when I met him and was ate the hamburger with him, but he had made Elvis what Elvis was already.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very fine fellow. I could find no fault. If I was looking for fault, I couldn't find any fault with Elvis, because he was my hero anyway at that time.
He was a lot of people's hero at that time. Still is, actually.
Oh, yeah. But we've had a lot of experiences with Jerry Lee Lewis, Charlie Rich, Conway Twitty, Hank Williams Jr., and all the big musicians in Nashville, Lady Bond of Memphis, and Scotty Moore, which is a personal, a special friend of mine, the Elvis' guitar player, and Johnny Cash. Johnny Cash is a fine fellow. He just liked his booze, but you know, I like to smoke cigarettes now. I don't know which is the worst, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just been a good life in the music business for me.
You had fun.
I had much fun.
A lot of fun.
Yes,
hard work, I'm sure, but I bet that was some fun times.
Right. Now, Charlie Rich said we played in the Laplighter Club in Memphis for a month. There was two or three times that he was not able to go to the hotel, which is the Tennessee Hotel. He and I both were staying at the Tennessee Hotel in downtown Memphis. And I would help him to his car, and I would drive him over there, take him and get him to bed, you know, take him up to his room. He didn't know where he was, but he could sit right at that moment. He could sit down at that piano and play the prettiest piano, sing the prettiest song you've ever heard.
Huh.
And I've never figured out how he did that. If I got drunk or something, I couldn't even remember the name of the song. I know how to do it and do such a pretty job of it. You know?
Couldn't walk, but he could
walk, but
he
could, he could certainly get it done. Yes, sir.
That was neat. Think of anything else for me?
Well, right offhand,
which that's a lot of information.
I've got a lot of things in my mind. If I could come up with it, such as this, you know, it's all that type entertaining and that type of people I dealt with and worked with. And we'd have the disc jockey convention at the Andrew Jackson Hotel in Nashville, and I was at that for 3 or 4 years, and seeing how the record companies and representatives of the companies would deal with the big disc jockeys over the nation from the big radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And met Tom Parker, Colonel Tom Parker, who was Elvis' manager.
Mm-hmm.
and met him and his cigar. he was a nice fella too, because he's the best promoter that God has ever let breathe.
Yeah.
You know? At the Andrew Jackson Hotel, they have the disc jockey convention there. It was before my music career time, but the fact is that Eddie Arnold was gotten off the ground by Colonel Tom Parker.
Mm-hmm.
And all the disc jockeys there at the from the big stations at the Andrew Jackson Hotel, record companies trying to get them to play my client's record, play that, you know, whining and dining them and all that. Colonel Tom Parker didn't do that. And he was the most effective of any of them. Like Eddie Arnold, when he was handling Eddie Arnold, before anybody knew who Eddie Arnold was, Colonel Tom pulled a full-grown elephant up to the front door of the Andrew Jackson Hotel right in the middle of the disc jockey convention and had a big cape over the elephant. It said on each side, said, "Play Eddie Arnold." And, you know, disc jockey saw that. They went back to the station and started playing Eddie Arnold because of the elephant.
Uh-huh.
He didn't try to con them into it or by buying them whining and dining them and all this thing and talking pretty words. He just said, "Play Eddie Arnold." That's a big old elephant standing there with that cape over his
head. And they did it.
Colonel Tom knew how to do it. In fact, the girls screaming and all, they'd done that to me when I was on stage several times. One night, the police in Moultrie had to escort me home because I was playing a football rivalry at the youth center in Moultrie, homecoming. And I was 16 years old, and I was on stage, me and my band, singing some of the Elvis songs, and on some of those songs, at that time, I followed Elvis so close that if you turned your head, you couldn't tell it was me singing or him, you know?
Well, you still did.
Well, but Moultrie was playing LaGrange.
Mm-hmm.
They were big rivals like Moultrie and Valdosta are now and have been for several years. But we started the show, and then girls started coming on the stage and screaming and hollering and cutting the food. But after we got through, the two policemen had to come on stage with me, keep the girls off the stage. And I was scared. I mean, I was scared young. You know, I was 16
years old.
And girls all over everywhere, and the place was full, and all the windows and doors full with heads stuck in, you know. Not even standing room inside. And then the police escorted me home. And I was big stuff then. I was scared of big stuff. I was frightened to death of that deal because I didn't know how to handle it. But the screaming, girls screaming and pulling their hair and throwing their shirt on the floor and that kind of thing. Colonel Tom Parker, back to him. When he first picked Elvis up and started promoting him, he planted 9 girls in the big auditorium, different place in the auditorium, hired them to do it. When Elvis come out, started singing, started screaming and running up down the aisle and all. That's where this came from. Colonel Tom Parker was a genius. He hired 9 girls, placed them all over the auditorium, and wanted to do it here, and hidden just all over the auditorium, they would do it because it's one he hired to, see. And then from that, it just picked up, and from then on, everywhere Elvis showed up, it was just a bunch of screaming going on, you know? But it was planted, it was done by the genius of the promoters, which is Colonel Tom Parker.
I never knew that at all.
That's where all that started.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah. And like Elvis, you know, he was such a promoter, you heard Elvis Presley's name before you ever heard him sing.
Mm-hmm.
I did. I knew who Elvis Presley was, but I'd never heard him sing. Because Colonel Tom Parker put it out in front, you know. He said, "Be heard a lot, seen a little," you know. And he was on the Ed Sullivan show after he did his Don't Be Cruel, Hound Dog, all that, and that gun got big. And people thought, well, Elvis couldn't do nothing but shake his legs. He couldn't sing. But anybody wants to say that, you try to follow
him. Mm-hmm.
You don't think he can sing, you try to stay with him. I've tried it, and I had never been able to stay with him, but he was a good singer and a good guy. Ed Sullivan made the statement on his show that time. They had just wanted to just film Elvis from the waist up because he would
break
his leg, which was ridiculous now, but at that time he wasn't that bad ridiculous. That was 100 years ago, it seemed like. Anyway, he stopped the show, Ed Sullivan did, and said, "Ladies and gentlemen," you know how he talked, "I want everybody to know that Elvis Presley is a fine young man." And he was. He was, no doubt about it. But he, that's the biggest thing on Sunday night, but ever, TV. But these big people are just the same size as me and you and everybody else. They've just got a lot of talent, and they've had a lot of good breaks. And I commend people that get breaks, legitimately. Mm-hmm. And all these people I've talked about are very, very talented.
It's good.
I just wish I had been that fortunate. It's my first deck of record. "You've Got Everything" is the name of it, written by Boo Love and Felice Friday, right? It sold 236,000 copies on Decca. And because I didn't have Colonel Tom Parker promote me, that I might have helped, you know. But I did fairly well, and I did enough to satisfy myself, you know. And I'm very happy with my past in these business. Now I'm selling vehicles. I'm a car salesman at Robert Hudson's in Mosul, Georgia, and I enjoy that. We sing at church, my wife Pat and I and you, and you know, we sing church, we sing funerals and weddings and parties, that type thing, you know, just for our own entertainment and for people's benefit. Do what we can. But like I said a while ago, it's all gotten to be an old hat to me, and I don't get excited about it anymore like I used to when I was young. But like I said again, I'm very proud and thankful for the experience that I've had. So that's about it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Dad, for doing the interview. I learned even things I didn't know this time. Well, I thought I heard it all.
Stories that I hadn't told.
But thank you, and gonna use you for my course project.
I'm
gonna go write it now. So thank you very much. And today again is November 10th, 1999. My name is Payne Roberts, and interviewing my dad, Kenny Roberts, which his stage name was Lance Roberts. That's it. Okay, here are a few selections from Kenny's recordings. The first one is "You've Got Everything," which was his number one seller out of all of them. And the second is "The Man in the Moon Showed Up."
Baby, I mean everything. Baby, be my baby, and I'll have everything to do. You beat anything, a kiss and right anything. Miss and be my baby, and I'll have everything to do. You've got more glamour than I've ever seen. Your lips are redder than a chili bean. I don't know any dolly half as keen as you. Your skin is smoother than a whipping cream. Your eyes are full of that certain gleam. You've got everything, you're a dream come true. You've got everything. Oh, baby, I mean everything. Oh, baby, be my baby, and I'll have everything too. You'll beat anything. Kissing, there ain't anything. Missing, be my baby, and I'll have everything too. You've got more sugar than a candy bar. A lot more sparkle than a movie star. I just can't tell you quite what you are to me. You're all the goodies underneath the sun. A load of loving and a load of fun. Yes, you've got everything. You're the one. company for me. You've got everything,
my baby,
I mean everything.
My baby,
be my baby, and I'll have everything to do. You beat anything, missing there ain't anything. Missing, be my baby, and I'll have everything to do. Be my baby, and I'll have everything to do.
My baby, and I love everything. The man in the moonshadow, why didn't you?
Do you remember asking the moon up on high to send down its light this Saturday night? You ask it to come out, you ask it to be true. Well, the man in the moon showed up.
Why didn't you?
Last week you said you loved me. Now you're not so sure, you know. Oh, who, I ask, is the reason why you didn't show? I'm not the only one stood up at our rendezvous. Why didn't you?
The man in the moon showed up. Why didn't you?
Last week you said you loved me. Now you're not sure, you know. Oh, who, may I ask, is the reason why you didn't show? I'm not the only one stood up at our rendezvous. 'Cause the man in the moon showed up.
Why didn't you?
Perhaps in the weeks to come he'll be saying to the man in the moon showed up.
Why didn't you? The man in the moon showed up. Why didn't you?